agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for a bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney Jay Carson.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Jay. You know, we were talking about, I said, should I add on Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson? What do you think about that?
I do like the defender of freedom moniker. That
we might have to go with that. It feels like it's a title that should come with a cape or something like that.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Or tights. But maybe we don't want to go.
We keep working on it.
Yeah. But, yeah. Definitely.
It's an improvement over what you usually call me.
There you go. So, all right, we will work on that. And before we do figure that out, we want to thank our newest supporters on Patreon, Austin, Robert, Ryan, Emmanuel, and Rachel. And Austin wrote in to say, you know, I figured it's finally time for me to pitch in. You all have been a staple of my weekend routine for well over 2 years now, and I appreciate the work. Well, we certainly appreciate the support from you, Austin, and from everyone else. So thank you very much. Of course, as a Patreon supporter, you don't just get that second full-length episode every week. You get ad-free versions of all our shows, as well as other stuff at different levels of support. And to check it all out, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to hear that weekly bonus show, but you can't afford to support the show financially right now, totally not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up with that. And if a monthly pledge, that's just too much of a commitment. I'd like to support us on a one-time or recurring basis, but you're not a fan of Patreon for whatever reason, there's our PayPal option. You can find that at politicsguys.com/support. And we are also at Venmo at politicsguys. All right. So this week we will be opening with the police shootings of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, Adam Toledo in Chicago, and the police incident with Army Second Lieutenant Karan Nazario in Windsor, Virginia. Now, Jay and I have been talking about policing in America just a number of times over the years. And so we thought that for this conversation, we invite in somebody who would maybe add a valuable perspective to this latest discussion. It's
somebody who actually knows some stuff.
There right? you go. Yeah, absolutely.
As we refer to them. Yes.
Yeah. We're happy to welcome to the show today my good friend Mark Marsolet. And Mark has had a career in the Houston police before earning a PhD in criminal justice and becoming a professor. And I think his combination of real world and academic experience is something that we could certainly benefit more from. And so I was really pleased when he agreed to join us on the show today for this segment. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. Good to be on the show with both you and Jay. Never been on before and looking forward to it, but thank you for the invite.
So I thought we would start with the Dante Wright shooting in Brooklyn Center. And, you know, like a lot of people, I've seen the video footage that was released. And one thing that I really struggled with, as a lot of people are, I think, is how it's possible for a veteran police officer to mistake a Glock for a taser. I mean, not only are they very different sizes and weights, but they're holstered on different sides. And so it's kind of a nuts and bolts thing, but I was hoping, we could get your perspective on this first off, Mark.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. You can stop me at any time, if I sound like I'm rambling, but one of the things I teach a use of force class at my college. In fact, I teach it every other semester. I also teach policing in America, but one of the things I have the students do is look at training. And if you look at training of police officers, it's, generally, within a certain, half a year time, little FTO training, stuff like that. Anytime a new weapon is introduced, well, the taser has been out there for a couple of decades, but the original taser didn't look anything like a pistol. It didn't have a pistol grip or anything, but it actually looked like a blocky flashlight. Having said that, whenever police officers are giving alternative weapons, they don't train as many hours with those weapons as they do with their sidearm. And so the human body has a tendency to go back to what they originally learned. Mixing up the two, people were talking about that. when we teach a new weapon, such as a taser, we don't have all the scenarios that somebody's going to be involved with. And I think the physiological aspect of being in a stressful situation, the officer is expecting, that person to stop, that person to cooperate. And then all of a sudden it turns into somebody's going to leave, somebody's going to be resisting. And then what does the body do? It automatically goes and, goes, if it feels like it needs a weapon, the police officer feels like they need a weapon, they're going to reach for that. What have they reached for more times than anything on their uniform? They've reached for their pistol. And so that's probably the predominant training that they have. I'll stop here, and let you ask any other questions, but I'll just stop.
I guess the fact that the pistol, I think it was the Brooklyn Center regulations, it's probably pretty common that the pistol is on the dominant side, whereas the taser is on the other side, probably even more. I would imagine a person is more inclined to just reach with their dominant hand, especially in a stressful situation then.
Yeah, that is correct. And, when training alternative weapons, less than lethal weapons, if you look at the number of hours that is spent on that, it's going to be less than that sidearm. And in fact, most officers don't get a significant amount of sidearm time. I mean, if you look at academy training, 40 to 60 hours of sidearm training. And you can't, during the time, you're learning how to basically use the weapon, whether it's the less than lethal or the sidearm. But that's the mechanics of shooting is one of the things that you take a lot of time up with. You don't take a lot of time up with scenarios, putting somebody into multiple scenarios, multiple variables, trying to make a determination when you use that or what you have in your hand.
So
Mark, I'm curious, and this is if you know, but this is not the first incident of this type where someone's been killed because an officer thought he or she was firing a taser, but was actually firing the sidearm. Do you have any sense or any numbers of how frequently these kind of mistakes, accidents, whatever you want to call them, happen?
Right now, the numbers I got this week was less than two dozen. And in fact, one of the news sources had said that there was only three that were convicted of, during the course of thought they were using the taser and they actually used their firearm. Yeah. So there's not been any high level of accidents like this and then, leading to criminal charges. So less than two dozen.
Do you think that this is at least, and we've seen other incidents where police responded in very high stress situations in ways where certainly almost anyone would at least question whether they were using an appropriate amount of force. And in some cases, just seeming to, at least to the casual observer, I guess you could say that clearly they were. Is this, to what extent would you say this is a training issue? And if so, what sort of implications does that have for the amount of time and resources that we communities put into police training?
Well, we touch upon training and I don't want to get on my soapbox about training.
That's why we're having you on, Mark.
Yeah, training does duplicate everything. We have the military. Until we send somebody into combat, you can go through all as many scenarios in one of the forts in the United States, and then send somebody to Iraq and Afghanistan, and then they get under combat, and that's the experience that's going to take place. What I think that a lot of people are missing on a lot of these shootings and. I have my opinions about these handlings of these situations, whether it's Ferguson, whether it's, the current trial that's going on with the ex-officer Chauvin. The variables that play into this, if we back everything up, and if you go to a roll call at the start of the shift, I don't recall any officer sitting there saying, I hope I get into a chase tonight. I hope I, get to use my taser. I hope I get to use my gun. So you have a situation where you have somebody that's a training officer, you know, and, you know, whether it's a traffic violation or not, and we can get into, you know, whether police should be stopping traffic violators. But so you have a, you know, you really have a preconceived notion of how this traffic stop's going to go. You know, people say you shouldn't assume anything. There's no scene of routine traffic stop. But, you know, we're checking boxes as a police officer. You know, stopping somebody, so you expect I'm going to get driver's license, proof of insurance. I'm going to explain to him why I'm stopping him. And then when things start to get awry or things don't, you know, work out in the scenario that you might have in your mind, then, you know, how is your body going to react? How are you going to react? How's your mind going to react? And we don't do enough of that. And I don't think that's a training issue. I mean, this woman had 26 years on of experience. But how many traffic stops did she, how many high risk traffic stops did she have? But the expectation was that this person would cooperate. And so, you know, is it a retraining issue? Maybe it is. But I think the buildup to this it's a fluid situation. And I think what people are looking at is videos where it's, okay, here's a slice. And I think that's problematic for a lot. A lot of police that get involved in these situations.
You know, I can understand. I mean, I've watched the videos that came out for all of these incidents. And you know, one thing when I looked at, for instance, the Wright or the Toledo videos, it seemed like, wow, things were happening awfully quickly. And honestly, I could hardly make sense of what was going on from the body cam video. But then I see something like the Karan Nazario incident where it didn't seem like a particularly high stress situation. You have a officer, you know, walking up to this guy and, you know, telling him that he's fixing the ride, the Lightning, and that he should be afraid to come out of the vehicle. And that to me it's harder for me to look at something like that and say, well, you know, this is just a high stress situation and an officer's reacting. To me, this seems like a small town cop who's pumped up with his own self-importance and feeling like he's above the law and acting as such. And I wanted to get your take on that and maybe the differences between those situations.
Well, okay, let me back up here a second. So, my understanding is the officers initially caught this. The lieutenant in sight, the military lieutenant, quite a distance back. The expectation was that he would stop immediately. That's one of the expectations of police. The lieutenant, in fact, decided, well, I want to go to a well-lit area, make sure that everything's okay. So he drives down the road. So what happens physiologically, and I've been in this situation before, you go to pop somebody, you know, you hit the lights, hit your siren, they don't pull over and say, okay, what do I got? Are they getting rid of evidence? Is there something going on? Are they eating drugs? Are they doing this? So those things will run through your mind. You know, the fact that the plate was in the back, it's a new vehicle, is that suspicious enough to stop? So let's back up before we get to the officers getting out of the vehicle and approaching and being unprofessional. But they are, in fact, you know, the physiological aspect and they're wandering and stuff like that. And do they have to come out so strong? Did they have to come out like that? I would say, no, they did not. But I also want to take into account what preceded all that. And I don't think that, you know, I don't know if it's a hiring issue, whether we like officers to be very physical. We like them to, you know, kind of take charge. That's why we hire them. You know, they have this command presence and all this sort of stuff. But at the same time, we don't do enough talking about, you know, talking oneself down like a hostage negotiation, say, oh, maybe this is what I have. Let me see what I have before I react this way. Whether it's a small town, you know, policing, I've seen a lot of small town police. They're very well trained. They go to a lot of training. They don't have a lot of calls. I've seen a lot of small town police officers. They do an excellent job. They do spend the time, because a small town usually invested in what's going on in the community. So, you know, in this case, pepper sprays to get somebody out of the vehicle. A lot of officers are being trained now, you know, let's not get into fights. Don't get injured. Use your pepper spray, use your taser and stuff like that. There has been a examination of, you know, whether we're these police officers are spending way too much on these less than lethal things rather than, you know, let's use, you know, what, you know, maybe calm down, start talking to people and stuff like that. They escalate it right away. And I guess that is a training issue.
Mark, and maybe this is an unfair question, but kind of going into the bigger picture, obviously underlying so many of these incidents is race. And there is the I guess the automatic response by some that every one of these incidents is necessarily a racial incident and occurs because of an underlying, whether you want to call it structural racism or institutional racism, unconscious racism, so forth. And I want to just kind of get your perspective, both as a former law enforcement officer, someone who works with a lot of cops, and as a professor now. What's your sense of how much race plays into these incidents? And I also understand that each one is different, has its own facts. Or is it more these other factors? I mean, humans under stress who can make mistakes, or just, I mean, bad training, bad apples, what have you?
Well, you said bad apples and we can talk about bad barrels, and I've got a kind of a thing that I'm working on. I'm going to get back to that when you talk about apples. But yeah, racism does play a part. Okay. You know, we've known that for years and years and years. I go back to, you know, at one time, one of the officers I worked with, his grandfather used to take him to Ku Klux Klan's meetings. So he still got hired. There's a officer, you know, I worked a predominantly African-American section in Houston, the Third Ward. And I didn't grow up like that. I grew up in, you know, kind of rural townish area, you know, 90% white. But I did go in the military. So a lot of my fellow soldiers were, you know, great mix of you know, Americans, you know. And so anyways, coming into policing, we do see that race factor is significant. They've hired more African-American officers. We've paired up more, you know, African-American officers, Hispanic officers, Latinx officers with, you know, the predominant white male, you know, that came out of the 1960s, 1970s. But, you know, racism is still a problem. And you can get somebody to go through the old interview process and stuff like that. And still, you know, how can you change, you know, there's a lot of times the way people grow up and what they've been exposed to as a family member. You know, you can keep that hidden during any sort of interview.
I would suppose that sort of thing would also be, I mean, resistant to any type of training, right? I mean, you could kind of probably put, if you've got someone like that who grew up going to Klan meetings, you could put them through all the diversity training in the world. And you know, would that change, you know, their mindset? I don't know. I mean, maybe, I suppose that depends on the individual.
Yep.
And that also, Jay, that also enters into this thing about the physiological response. If you've been taught that, you know, a certain, and I use purple people in my class. I said, if you've been taught that, you know, or learned that purple people are a threat to our way of life, purple people engage in crime, purple people do this, then in fact, all right, now if you're in a situation where you're an officer, and you've already been trained and stuff, but you've perceived purple people as a threat all your life, or you've been told they're a threat all your life, even with training at the academy, diversity training, exposure to officers that are purple, you know, it that's going to enter into, you know, this kind of this physiological response and psychological response. And I want to say that, you know, this is 2021 and we saw some changes from the 1960s, 1970s, community policing, 1980s. And I thought policing was significantly improving. I'm not sure that 9/11, you know, heading back to threats and threats didn't do more damage to policing than, you know, some of the other stuff that's going on.
You know, you mentioned, Mark, community policing and fear of purple people and that sort of thing. And that kind of raised a question for me is looking at police compared to the communities that they work in. And for instance, take Brooklyn Center. Brooklyn Center, according to last census report, is around 29% Black, but the police force is not even 9% Black. And not one of the Brooklyn Center police, according to the interim chief, it said not one of them actually live in the city they're policing. So it seems to me that, and maybe this isn't all that uncommon, you have these people coming in from the outside who don't live in the community and who don't look like, in many cases, the people who they are interacting with. And it seems to me that that's kind of problematic. And I want to get your take on that.
Yeah, it is problematic. But, you know, you look at the something like Cincinnati, where does the majority of this Cincinnati police force live? Not within the city limits, as far as I know. We experience the same thing in Houston with, you know, probably maybe one quarter of the officers living within the city, the rest living in the outskirts. I want to be careful here. You know, I've seen, you know, really, you know, officers that become invested in a community. They may have not come from that community, but become invested in that community at the local level, working with people, not of the same ethnicity, not of the same race, and do a very, very good job. I think it's important that you have members of the community be part of the police department. But I also found out that, you know, a reason Houston hired so many outside officers, they couldn't get people from Houston to join the police department. They couldn't get people from Texas to join the police department. My class was probably 50 to 60% outside of Texas. That's where they were recruited from. I think it's essential. It's the ability to learn, though, to work within the community. I did not grow up in an African-American community. I grew up in a white town dominated by white. I went to Houston. I worked predominantly in a third ward area, the African-American area. And it was eye-opening. It was a learning experience. But I also worked with officers who were willing to learn and work with the people. And they weren't of that, you know, they weren't from within the city. Now, I want to get back up here. You talk about, Minnesota, but go back to Ferguson. The same thing was found in Ferguson, is that, you know, the Ferguson is dominated by African-Americans. But at the time of the Michael Brown incident, the force itself was, predominantly white. And many of those officers were from outside. And that is perceived as an occupying that is where a lot of relationships go south, is when the police are seen, you know, as occupiers. That has to be corrected, whether it's corrected by having people hired from within the community or making sure that people are, spend a lot of time in the community and feel very comfortable, not sit there and say, well, I just get my paycheck here and I'm going out and leaving. So I think community policing was one of the best things that happened to police work. I think in many respects, we've probably gotten away from that. And that's why I said, go back to the 9/11 with the, you know, kind of the homeland security and anti-terrorism and profiling, you know, during the community policing, when the community policing, they were saying, okay, we're going to, you know, this profiling has to stop. Well, what happened after 9/11? What did the federal government say? What did local government say? We got to stop profiling, you know, terrorists. And so it sort of came back in. There's also this militarization of policing really took off post 9/11.
Yeah, it seems to me that also, I mean, there's also this, right, the thin blue line thing. I mean, there's the shot that a lot of people saw of the day after the shooting in Brooklyn Center, the police raised the thin blue line flag and so forth. And I mean, there's that, but there's also this sense that at least I think a lot of people feel is that the police feel like it's an us versus them thing as opposed to sort of a protect and serve. And there's this sort of adversarial feeling going in that maybe is actually even exacerbated by what some people would describe as the kind of paramilitary nature of police academies and police training, and that it creates a culture of where you're going into it feeling like this is the enemy out here as opposed to the community that I'm supposed to serve. I mean, what's your sense of that?
That, you know, you're going to get into my lectures here, and you know, we've only got so many minutes. But here, one of the things that I talk about, nobody's born a police officer. Okay. You know, I told the class one time, nobody's going to police officers because no woman wants to give birth to somebody with a gun and a badge. But anyways, the thing is nobody's born a police officer. Where do the police officers come from? They're American citizens, and they're expected to represent the government. And so I think we lose sight of it. I don't say we lost sight of it, because there's a lot of officers out there that don't engage in that us versus them mentality. And that is part of the police culture, because, you know, I worked night shift for many years. Who's out at night? You know, to us, you know, bad guys and bad girls are out at night. And so, you know, that's, you know, the police us versus them. But in actuality, you know, the police are part of the, you know, that's where they come from, is they are part of the community and should never, ever. They're not an occupying army. We have a tendency, though, police unions and stuff like that, they really stress their safety, you know, rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6. And, you know, that kind of culture, that has lessened over the years. But that doesn't mean that, you know, isn't tremendous pockets of that. And so, you know, it's to forget that you are, after all, an American citizen that's given you're in a profession, and that you're working with American citizens, you're helping American citizens. There's a lot of police departments that really are, you're hitting on that and getting away from the us versus them mentality. There's also the, you know, the warrior mentality. We called ourselves the Third Ward Warriors, you know, in night shift. But in actuality, you know, we're really, you know, peacekeepers and just trying to maintain order, not so much warrior mentality. Once you get that warrior mentality, then, you know, it's us versus them. So us versus them is there, but I think it's lessened tremendously so over the last couple of decades.
We're just going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with a continuation of this story. Some more questions for Mark. All right. So, Mark, you know, one other thing I wanted to ask you is, and I think, Jay, this is something you and I, while we usually disagree on unions, I actually suggested that in the past that maybe part of the problem here is, well, with police unions. And you know, I understand that the role of any union is to protect and to work for the benefit of its members. But it seems like that in at least many communities, police unions have kind of been able to negotiate these agreements that make it harder to discipline or dismiss problem officers, that make it harder to be transparent about disciplinary histories and that sort of thing. And also even, you know, sometimes give officers involved in incidents protections that no one else receives, in addition maybe to mandating hiring practices, saying that, for instance, officers can live outside the city and that sort of thing. And I was wondering, you know, obviously you were part of a police union, and so you know this from the inside, but do you feel like in some instances police unions are, in a way, part of the problem?
Without a doubt. I think there's very strong unions out there that have, because they're very well politically connected. One only has to look at the, Suffolk police in New York and some of the stuff that they're going through, but they have PACs. They're very politically connected. They support certain candidates. And so when they support a candidate, then of course, then they have proposals that are going to get okayed, whether it's a city council, whether it's a mayor, or some, county official, elected official that they do support. Police unions run the gamut. You know, throughout the South, the police unions aren't as strong as, you know, kind of the Northeast and the Northern unions. That could, let's say, for example, training. If a police union is sponsoring some sort of defensive tactics training, chokehold training, something, I'm just, you know, speaking off the top of my head here. But the police department's policy is that nobody will learn to do chokeholds. Well, if you have a strong union that says, well, we've got a specialist going to come in and teach us how to safely do chokeholds, then that union's probably going to, you know, bring a bunch of officers in and teach them the chokehold, when in fact that may be, you know, a violation of the policy of that police department or the city. But they wouldn't pay for the chokehold training, but they would, you know, the officers would be trained in that. So this is something that, you know, is of concern. And you know, I was a member of a union. I saw the need for the union, especially for legal representation anytime you would you know, I have an officer accused of wrongdoing, and he or she is in the right. They need that legal representation. And in fact, some police chiefs and police commissions are not very fair. And so they will terminate officers, or they'll keep officers. We had a case I was just talking about in class the other day. Two officers, both were caught stealing. One was caught stealing overtime. The other one was caught, you know, stealing some supplies or something. The officer that got caught stealing overtime was given 10 days off. The other officer was fired. Both were stealing. The officer that got fired, in his defense, what he used, he told the union. That's what the union represented him. They said, they're both thieves. This other one needs his job back. So the department ended with, you know, two police officers that have been found to be stealing, but they had to hire the other one back. And that was through the union. People cringe at that, but on the other hand, people say, well, that's fair. I was talking to somebody one time about the Boston police and supervision, and I was a supervisor, and I said, this is what we do as a supervisor. And I was told that in the Boston police, supervisors couldn't do that. And I said, well, they're not really supervisors then. And that really kind of set me back. But I think the police unions, they're feeling the heat right now. Many of the police unions are feeling the heat because of some of the stuff that they've been involved with in defending some of these officers, these bad officers that have kept their jobs. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
So I'm going to sort of take the other piece of this, and that is intake and recruitment. I served for several years on our city's Civil Service Commission, and we had a chief and a department that was really good in terms of screening folks as they came in. And I'm wondering just what your thoughts are on the role of groups like Civil Service Commissions or other pre-screening. Does doing a better job on the front end, will that make a difference down the road?
Yeah, I think Jay, that is something that I'm putting to paper. You know, there's been talk about defunding the police, and I don't think that's going to happen. We're going to have police. So what do we need to do? Years and years ago, I'm going to talk about K-9. I ran a K-9 unit for the police department. But what we did was reverse engineer. We were getting in situations where the dogs weren't performing, training wasn't making up for it. And we came up, a good friend of mine, we came up with reverse. And what is it that we need to do this job? And so we said, we need to screen the K-9s better. And so I think it's time to reverse engineer. What is it that you want? I'm glad to hear you say that you did serve on something. That input is really important. A lot of police departments don't want that input, but I think it's so important because I remember, where do the police come from? They come from the community. So we want to reverse engineer and say, what does that ideal officer look like? Okay. And then we have to start recruiting. Now, having said that, you also pay for what you get. If you're paying $40,000 a year, you're not going to get, you know, the super officer, you know, he or she is, you know, going to go to some other place, some other department. But we keep talking about training. Okay, we got to do diversity training. We got to do this. Why aren't we loading the front end up with people that are already comfortable with diversity? Why aren't we loading the front end? So I think it's so, so important to do that. I think that's going to be the key. I think some police departments, I'm going to say this, I think some police departments may have to just check their whole police department, just like the military does, with a unit and go, you know what? There's a lot of controversy right now with, you know, the Navy SEALs a couple of years back. They disbanded some of those and said, we got to start again. That's very time consuming. It's very costly. It's no guarantee. But I think in some cases that police departments may be looking to do that. That's where the unions come into play, and that's where civil service comes into play, because how do you get rid of a bunch of problem officers? You know, it's not just a bad apple, but it may be, you know, a bad barrel of them. So.
Yeah, and just so I can give listeners who aren't familiar with the process about what I was talking about in the civil service process, the way it works, at least up here, is Those who want to apply take a generalized test. From the group of people who get a certain score on the test, the city creates what's called an eligible list of folks who can be hired off that list. And from there, then there was additional screening that got to the point of once, you know, you were on the top 10, I think, in the eligibility list, you'd have additional interviews, you'd have polygraph tests, you'd have background checks. And what we ran into as a Civil Service Commission is during some of these interviews, during these background checks, we'd find people on the eligible list who had some not insignificant criminal histories drug issues or psychological issues that showed up down the road. And then what happens is the police chief would come to the Civil Service Commission and say, we have concerns about these folks based on this. And, you know, the Civil Service Commission then takes a look at it and decides whether to keep them or strike them from the eligible list. And that's kind of how the process works, at least in my community. I was surprised at the number of people who wanted to be police officers, who had some pretty significant background issues. And again, we were careful not to say, listen, you had, you know, whatever, some youthful indiscretion kind of thing. But, there were candidates who, had significant misdemeanors, like within the last 3 months. I mean, it was that sort of thing. That's really impressed upon me. Yeah. The fact that if all communities did more rigorous screening, that might weed out some of the people who are, one, either psychologically unfit, right, or just have, you know, appear from their life choices to make perpetually, you know, bad judgments, right? So,
but, you know, going back, going back to what you said a little earlier and on Jay's comment there, you know, for a long time, or at least since all this really kind of started to come up, my argument has been that defund the police, we should do exactly the opposite, is provide the resources for better screening and better pay, but also along with that, have higher standards. And I've referenced, for instance, the latest agreement between the police union and the city of Cincinnati, where there were raises, but they also were accompanied with other more stringent requirements in terms of, I believe, performance and transparency with the union. And to me, it seems like that's a way forward that's much more likely to provide something positive as opposed to just sort of cutting resources and they're just hoping that the problem will sort of magically solve itself.
No, I agree. I think, you know, the community gets the policing that they pay for. It's so important to send a message to those that get selected. You know, a lot of times police officers, police departments go out there, we want you. And then they forget to say, this is what we expect of you. And I think that what you're talking about there, exactly, this is what we're going to give you. This is what we want. And this is what we expect out of you. I think that needs to be very, very clear. There is not a lot of training in, we say, well, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to tolerate that. But if police departments sat there and hired, you know, a bunch of, you know, great candidates and turned around and one of those great candidates messed up and it messed up really bad, rather than, do we retrain them or do we terminate them? And then we make a statement there. So, It's got to be very, very clear. The problem is across the United States, there's a number of police departments that need police officers all across the United States. Maine is no exception. They need police officers. They're not getting them. So some police departments make the decision to say, well, we'll take, you know, we'll go off of the list, you know, Jay's list of eligibility. We'll go down a little bit further and take those officers. And, you know,
That's an excellent point. I'm in a community where a lot of people want to work here and want to be police officers. So we, you know, fortunately had sort of our pick of the litter, so to speak, and some really great qualified people. But there's a lot of communities that just don't have that. And if they're going to have, you know, they may not have that luxury.
You know, Before we move on to our next story, I did have one final question for you, Mark. I've noticed, at least in some sectors, a lot of people saying, well, you know what? This really isn't an issue because if people didn't resist, there wouldn't be a problem. And so people who resist sort of get what's coming to them. And as long as you just obey and comply and submit to the police, there's never going to be an issue with that. And I wanted to get your take on that.
I'm kind of chuckling to myself because now you're saying, well, we've got to train the citizens. So what class do we give, young people in high school? Okay, when the police stop you, but when you see the police do this, you know, and we don't take into account a lot of times, you know, citizens and their expectation of what the police is supposed to do. And I know there's attorneys out there that they sponsor these, ads that say, well, the police do this, you don't have to do this, and you can do this. And we try to get that out to the community. I want to take that the lieutenant in Virginia, he seemed to be doing everything right, you know, as a black Hispanic, his hands and all that sort of stuff. He put him out there and he was talking calmly. It's one of those issues, I think, that what do we do with citizens? You know, do we train them? Do we give them education? And, I don't know. I mean, now you got me at a loss for words. So,
I'll just shoot in. I mean, I remember back, again, 100 years ago when I took driver's training, that was part of the instruction is if you're pulled over, here's what you do. Please, have your license and registration ready, put your hands up where they can be seen. All these steps to de-escalate, so that an officer approaching you has no reason, to be on sort of high alert or to have that physiological response, kick in. I think, Mike, you framed it as these people who get, who don't comply, get what's coming to them. And I don't think that's the way I'd frame it, I think if we can communicate and people understand that, listen, if you're not going to comply with the police, you're putting yourself at risk, and you're putting that police officer in a situation where they're going to have to respond to something and
right, which in no way suggests that the police have any right to excessive use of force if you don't comply.
No, absolutely not. But I'm just saying that. If you are in a situation where you are not complying with a police directive, your risk of getting shot, having action taken against you, rises significantly.
And I just got to say on this issue, I just feel like though it's a very we're three white guys here talking, and our experiences throughout our lifetimes with authority with law enforcement are just very different than a lot of black and other minority folks. I mean, I've talked to some of the black students in my classes, and they're, certainly their experiences of a lifetime with law enforcement are very different, and ones that make it, I would say, not necessarily as easy as it would be for any of us to say, oh, well, it's just a cop. And what did I do? I guess I'll have to pay a fine or something, where there are people who are really in fear. And, earlier Mark talked about how police can react out of fear and stress. Well, of course, that also applies to people who are pulled over who, I think in some reason when, a cop says to you, yeah, you should be afraid. Well, that's a pretty big problem.
And that's a different. Yeah, that's a different sort of story, but
I know we need to move on, but I just want to thank you, Mark, for coming on, because I really do feel that this was a perspective that really been missing from our previous conversations that unfortunately we've had all too many of given all the incidents. But we really do appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and talk with us about this.
All right, thank you very much, both of you. Want to leave you with this thought. I look at this as an opportunity for better policing in the future. I'm not going to get down I think that the history of policing has shown that there's setbacks, but out of that comes improvement. So again, my former brothers and sisters that are on the force, I mean, they need to be safe and they need to exercise good judgment. I think it's going to be a significant improvement with policing.
Let's definitely hope so. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back. Jay and I will be talking about the announced withdrawal from Afghanistan. That'll be just in 1 minute. Okay, so we are back, and second story we want to talk about today on the show is that President Biden this week announced that all U.S. troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan by September 11th this year, which, of course, is the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Biden said, "I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan, two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth." And he went on to say that the main argument for staying longer is what each of my three predecessors have grappled with. No one wants to say that we should be in Afghanistan forever, but they insist now is not the right moment to leave. And of course, I should point out, Jay, that this presence in Afghanistan has lasted much, much longer than was ever initially envisioned. And the mission has changed as well, from defeating Al-Qaeda to the much broader mission to build and support kind of a capable democratic central government and security system in Afghanistan that could withstand the threat posed by the Taliban. But after nearly two decades and hundreds of billions of dollars spent on military and police in Afghanistan, what we've gotten is what's widely viewed to be a hopelessly corrupt, incompetent, and incredibly weak force that seems to be pretty unlikely to stand against the Taliban. And, in response to this, congressional Republicans, they seem to have been pretty negative in their reactions. Mitch McConnell said the administration decided to abandon U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, which have helped keep radical Islamic terrorism in check, and that apparently we're to help our adversaries ring in the anniversary of 9/11 attacks by gift wrapping the country and handing it right back to them. So, Jay, one of our supporters, actually, Tyler Six, said this seemed to be an issue where the U.S. is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. And I wanted to, get your thoughts on that. Do you agree with, I could say both President Biden and President Trump before him on this, because it's just Biden's kind of a continuation of the Trump trajectory. Or do you think
was going to get out earlier?
Yeah. In fact, so what do you think about this announcement? I mean, is it you think it'll prove to be a mistake, as a lot of congressional Republicans suggest, or where are you on this?
Where am I? So I think there are a lot of there's a split among conservatives on this. There are a lot of folks out there who are saying, yes, we've sunk far too much into this. This is not our fight. We have no interest there anymore. And then there are the more the Mitch McConnell type, and I would probably put myself closer to the latter. I was not crazy about with the withdrawal when Trump announced it. I'm trying to think back exactly when we talked about it on the show at some point. And my sense was that at this point we have 2,500 troops there. So not a significant military presence to do anything, but more a tripwire presence. I can't tell you what the right number is. But I have concerns about the message, of a complete pullout. I have even bigger concerns about the messaging of having a pullout on the anniversary of 9/11. That to me is what I find completely baffling. If we want to draw down or even pull troops out, why do this? I mean, we've had troops in Japan for how long, basically since World War II. And if we were to say, if we were to have said back in, let's say 1962, we're going to pull our troops out on December 7th. What message would that have sent? So that part eludes me. The 9/11 anniversary, I think, is terrible. That's more optics than it is substance, but still optics count. And something that, we always used to talk about in the Cold War, is the the ability of the folks we ask to be our allies. Can they rely on us? And I think that's another sense of that's part of power. That's part of the soft power we talk about a lot, that that folks, if they support the United States and people who are risking their lives to do so, and then we leave them, abandon them, that diminishes our ability to project force around the globe. So if we need to draw down troops, I think that's a good idea. Active hostilities there have essentially ceased, right? Where it's not an act of war. But that said, I really have issues with the goodbye, we're leaving, happy 9/11.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I think I have a problem with the analogy you draw, because in 1962, Japan was a stable democratic regime without the sort of endemic corruption problems. There never really was
a
government.
Right. But I think it still would have sent a horrible message if we left on December 7th.
Well, I see a lot of people on the left see it the other way. A lot of people, maybe even on the libertarian right, see it the other way, saying that, this is the 20th anniversary, and we accomplished our initial goal, which was set by, President George W. Bush, who famously said we should not get involved in nation building. And boy, I think, that kind of makes sense, either do it big or do it not at all. And, I read Bush's initial statements and, this might take a year or so, maybe even as much as a year or two. But the mission changed. And we have an ally who is the Afghan government is horrifically corrupt. And so we're trying to prop up this house of cards. So it's very different than being loyal to a real partner government.
Let me be clear. When I say allies, I'm not necessarily referring to the Afghan government, but I am referring to a lot of the Afghan people.
So then let me ask
you, who had assisted us, and then to other allies who we might seek to recruit, who would be actualized. I agree wholeheartedly that the Afghan government has, from day one, has been ridiculously corrupt, inept. I mean, put in whatever adjective you want.
So then you're for nation building. You think this is a great way to spend our time and money?
Well, if the initial reason for going into Afghanistan was to remove the Taliban from power.
Remember, it was to remove Al Qaeda.
Well, no, but the idea was that the Taliban were providing a safe haven for Al Qaeda. And that was the plan, was to remove those safe havens for terrorism. I think that's a problem. And I very much, when we pulled out of Iraq, the Islamic State rushed in to fill that vacuum. So that's what I'm concerned about is that the Taliban will rush back in and will be essentially running Afghanistan and able to provide that safe haven for terrorists again before too long.
And so then you would prefer a situation where we just basically said we're going to keep thousands of troops in Afghanistan indefinitely.
I'm not committed on the number, but I think having a presence there is important.
Even though the fact that we have a presence there has been essentially one of the reasons why the Taliban has just suggested that, we're not going to do any kind of negotiation or work in any kind of power sharing agreement. I guess what I'm saying, Jay, is that it seems to me.
But let's also look at it this way. We haven't had a major terrorist attack since 9/11. There aren't places. There were for a while, I think, during the Islamic State, caliphate. But terrorists don't have those bases of operations anymore. So, I think there's some value there that we can't overlook.
And so you think it's enough of a, I mean, obviously we don't know, we don't have any access to the intelligence or, you know, what's going on with international terrorism, but you feel that the amount of time and resources and, you know, potential lives that we are willing to put up to this is based on our admittedly very, very rudimentary knowledge without any of the, you know, security information, that you think that's, you feel more confident in agreeing with Mitch McConnell as opposed to Joe Biden saying that, yeah, this is fine. It's an open-ended commitment, and we're just going to stay here and assume that the Taliban will never negotiate with the Afghan government. But we're not going to do more, so we're not going to try to actually eliminate the threat, but we're just going to keep on pouring money into this corrupt system, which doesn't seem to be getting any better a generation after we started. I mean, should we just kind of keep, I guess what I'm saying is that you're just saying maintain the status quo and just assume that.
Do you think the Taliban will negotiate with the Afghan government once we leave?
Oh, no, I think it's no, not at all.
No.
but I guess I'm saying
we either, if somebody wants to make the argument that this is not our war, that this is, you know, the other side of the world and it doesn't affect us, and why do we send people there? Well, yeah, that, and we don't want to engage in nation building. That was something that George W. Bush ran on, and he made a big piece of it. And then 9/11 happened, and to me, I think that told a lot of people that we do have to care about what goes on in some place in the other end of the world that we otherwise would have no interest in. Because look, it hit home. And that is, you know, that's part of just the way the world is.
I get that argument, Jay, but what I'm saying is that it seems to me that what we're doing right now is ineffective. The Taliban, you know, is a clear force in Afghanistan, right? That, I mean, it just seems to me that this is just an endless black hole that we're dumping money and resources in. And you either, at some point, you either, you know, go big or you go home. Well, we tried going big, right? The surge under President Obama. And, you know, that was something that Vice President at the time, Biden, was not a fan of. But at some point, don't you have to say, we either need to change our tactics or we need to just pull out altogether, as opposed to just saying, well, we'll just keep on doing this thing that doesn't seem to be working, and we'll just plan on doing it basically forever with no clear goals in mind, just saying, I don't know, I guess we'll fight, this is fighting terrorism somehow.
Well, we had a policy like that for, you know, 70-some years against communism. It was called containment. And if you, maybe that's what we're talking about. No one has articulated in that way. And maybe nation building is not something that we can or should engage in, but containment's something different.
What do you mean by containment, I guess? Because it seems to me that's a concept from, you know, the days of nation states and, you know, this idea of where we could clearly see the enemy. But terrorism seems to me to be a very different sort of thing, because it can operate out of any kind of, you know, failed state or partially failed state like Afghanistan. And so basically, you know, it's one thing to fight communism and the expansion of the Soviets into, you know, Western Europe or something like that. But it's another thing to fight this amorphous concept known of as terrorism.
Yeah, well, it's much more difficult. But I think the principle is the same, is that you deny the terrorists any actual territory or any form of government aid or shelter. And that's why we went in there in the first place, was because the Taliban allowed Al-Qaeda to use its country, Afghanistan, as I shouldn't say its country, use Afghanistan as its base of operations and to operate with impunity there. And it was sort of sheltered, you know, by a, you know, nation state. And you know, similarly, again, the Islamic the caliphate, too, the idea was, they wanted the whole territory, right? That was a big part of their ideology. So to me, look, I get it. It's different than the Russians pouring through the fold of Gap, right?
Yeah.
But to another extent, it's the idea of we're not going to just let areas be uncontested and say, listen, okay, feel free to erect your terrorism, state sponsor of terrorism state here. You can say it's been unsuccessful, but I'll point back again that there hasn't been a major terrorist incident since 9/11. And we have, sent Al-Qaeda sort of to the wind, right? They're still out there, in various pockets here and there, but they don't have, the same sort of command structure and we don't have the kind of place where an Osama bin Laden, can hide out. So.
Yeah, no, I, like I said, I have been, if one would look back to my comments of this over time, one would see that I'm conflicted over this, because actually I tend to agree with Tyler Six. It just seems like we have no good options in this instance. And, but I do feel like if we take seriously your arguments, and I think we should, then it just seems to me like there should be a better option than cutting out and going home entirely, or just doing the same old thing that we've been doing and pouring money into this corrupt. Because of course, part of the issues we have in the modern Middle East, one would argue, have come back to are the things we did in the name of containment and supporting corrupt regimes and the people losing the people and so
right.
I mean, I do think it is an awful decision either way, and I think that reasonable people can come to very different conclusions on this incredibly wrenching decision.
And look, to be clear, we're talking about 2,500 troops. And again, my issue is less with the number, and more just with the symbolism. There was the meeting where Blinken was telling the Afghan president, "Oh, hey, we're still with you. We're still with you. Don't worry, you can count on us. We're out of here." That to me is the issue. If you're just saying we're gone, there's no troops. That sends a message to not just to the Taliban, but also to other international rivals. I mean, what message does that send to the Russians or the Chinese?
But the other message is when people, are extorted by these military units who decide to set up shop for themselves, and it's done with, U.S., in part U.S. equipment and indirect assistance, then you have another message that's sent, is that the United States is happy to support corrupt regimes. And that's problematic too. I think you'd agree.
Yes, it is, but less so, right? Because I think what we're talking about is power politics.
Yeah,
right. And it's look, you can say that it's kind of like what Lyndon Johnson said about the South Vietnamese. I mean, it's, son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. That's not an ideal situation, but. I think if you have two bad choices, one being abandon and say, hey, look, we're not going to play in this field. We're going to surrender the field to the other side because our proxy is corrupt.
The
Chinese are not worrying about whether their proxies, again, shall we say, allies, are corrupt or not.
But we're the United States, and I think that's an important difference, is there are certain values we stand for, certain sure. things we believe in that the Russians and the Chinese don't. And so we should hold ourselves and our allies to a higher standard. And it seems to me that, and this is way overly simplistic, I will be the first to admit this, but that we should be willing and able to use our support or our pledge of support as leverage to get our partners to move in the direction we would like them to, toward a more open,
right,
free,
well,
direction.
Exactly. But the pledge of support is worth nothing. You don't understand?
Yeah. I mean, no, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
In the future, if we then go and tell other governments, hey, look, if you reform, don't worry, we got your back. We're going to stick with you for the long haul. And they're going to say, well, like you did for the Afghans, like you did for the South Vietnamese.
And I understand.
You know what I mean? That's where what I'm saying is it impacts the soft power that we're able to project.
But then again, you can say, you know, you have to work with what you have. And so you could also say, well, like you did with the Israelis. Yeah, exactly. Because we've been a staunch supporter of that government for generations, or like you did for the South Koreans, or like you did for the Japanese. Absolutely so. But these were all cases where there was enough of a structure to build on that we could actually build. And in these cases, it's a lot more difficult because Afghanistan is called Graveyard of Empires, right? Because there's not really a government there. It's this sort of artificial creation that has been a lot of people have tried to prop up, but there's really not much there.
Yeah, no, and those are South Korea, Japan, and Israel are three really great examples, I think.
Yeah.
You did have real democratic governments there. And again, none of them, I would say, are free from corruption because no government is, but it's not Afghanistan.
My
last piece would be just on the, again, this is sort of the, I'm being kind of, you know, Kissinger-esque kind of view here. I mean, look, we've had some pretty terrible allies. In World War II, we were allies with a guy named Joe Stalin, who may well have been one of the, you know, two or three worst people in all of human history. But we did it out of necessity, because the alternative was worse. And you know, I think dealing with corruption in some place like Afghanistan, yes, they're certainly bad news. They're not Stalin. You know, you can kind of do that moral calculus and say, listen, this is not the ideal situation. This is not who I'd like to be dealing with. But this is who I am dealing with. And these are my choices.
Yeah.
I can deal with a corrupt, this guy who's corrupt, or I can deal with the Taliban.
Yeah, well, but again, I would say it doesn't necessarily have to be a binary thing. As you can say, I can deal with this corrupt regime, but at the same time, not just simply accepting their corruption, but working and pressuring them to make reforms, right? I mean, you would agree with that, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And maybe
but you need to be kind of clear eyed in that.
Sure.
They might not make those reforms.
Yeah, absolutely. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep on pushing for that. And I think there's always going to be a tension there, certainly, because, again, in terms of Afghanistan, it's just there's not that structure to build from in the first place that there was in South Korea and there was in Japan and Israel and so forth, which makes it so much harder. So I think, Jay, in the end, both you and I agree with Tyler Six that there really just aren't any. It's like the least bad choice you can make.
Right. You and I are just choosing different bad options. Bad.
Yeah, exactly.
We're making different choices as to which one's the least bad.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we have run a little bit long today, but there's so much more we want to get to, and we will get to that on the bonus show. We want to talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause and what that means, the latest round of Russia sanctions, maybe even expanding the Supreme Court. There was legislation introduced this last week in Congress about that. I think I know, Jay, how you feel about that, but we will get to all of that on the midweek bonus show. And if you are a supporter, that will be in your feed on Wednesday morning. And if you're not a supporter, you can become one by just going to patreon.com/politicsguys. Or if you would like that midweek show, you're just not in a position to be able to support the show right now, totally get it. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up to get that midweek show. One thing that doesn't cost anything and really does help us out is if you could subscribe to the show, leave ratings and reviews, and especially if you could share your favorite episodes on social media. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook, on Twitter, and you will find those links in our show notes. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Morano, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Nathan Sosnowski. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.